Good morning, and hello, chaps and chapesses. Now today, there's something I'd like to talk to you about. It's something that's been on my mind for a while, chaps. It's been something I've been thinking about since, well, I suppose since kind of July. Since July last year, when the great honour was bestowed upon me of becoming the old First Lord of the Treasury of Britain, of Her Majesty's. Majesty's governed, and what that great honour is that issue is what I've been really thinking about. I've been mulling it over in the old non there, is leadership, and that is why is it that the people of Britain why would they want to elect someone like myself, someone who comes across as a bit of a buffoon sometimes. It's I'd be the first to admit that sometimes it's quite useful to be seen as not entirely knowing what one is thinking or what one is talking about. And those are kind of people, those are qualities in me that people seem to quite like, folks. They seem to enjoy those. And so what I got thinking about was for this, from a sort of an evolutionary perspective, from the perspective of Charles Darwin and all that good science and all that stuff, why is it that people are interested in people like me? Why is it that certain kinds of people become very popular leaders of countries? And so hello, and that's what I'd like to discuss today. Why is it that we certain kinds of people become leaders and certain kinds of people become followers? And why is it that across different social organizations, whether we're talking about tribes, hunter-gatherer tribes like the San of the Kalahari Desert, or whether we're talking about complex societies like our own, why is it that there is this tendency for certain kinds of people with certain characteristics to become leaders and for certain kinds of people to be followers? And that's what I want to address today. Now, there's a very interesting paper on this that was drawn to my attention by one of my wonderful subscribers and patrons, Oliver Arena Hills Esquire, on the evolutionary psychology of leadership by Mark van Vught and Richard Rone. And what they look at is basically the idea that until 13,000 years ago, we were living in hunter-gatherer bands. There was no farming until 13,000 years ago. So all of us lived in these small-scale hunter-gatherer kinship-based bands in which we were all closely related. And so consequently, the change has been very rapid from living in hunter-gatherer bands to living in these incredibly complex societies. And so their idea is that there is a strong degree to which we are still evolved psychologically to live in hunter-gatherer bands. We still maintain the evolutionary adaptations of the mind that we developed for our long prehistory living in hunter-gatherer bands now. And this explains why we like certain kinds of leaders and why we like the kinds of leaders that would have been the kinds of leaders that would have emerged into power and taken control of hunter-gatherer bands and been the big men, been the leaders, the chiefs of these hunter-gatherer bands. Now, I'm not sure they're quite right. I think that they exaggerate the extent to which we still have the psychological machinery of our hunter-gatherer past, because it should be remembered that we were under harsh Darwinian selection, in which there was 50% child mortality, in which 20% of people then witnessed all of their children die before they died, and in which 20% of people never married until as recent as 1800. And so until as recent as 1800 in Western countries, only 10% of the population passed on their genes. So it could be argued that evolution sped up as we moved out of the Pleistocene, as we moved into the Holocene. Evolution sped up and became more intense. But therefore, it's a bit of an exaggeration to say that we're simply evolved to the savannah and we're living somewhere else. But it is certainly true that we have maintained many cognitive biases and whatever that we evolved under those conditions. We have maintained those to this day, and evolutionary psychological research has demonstrated that. And this links to the issue of leadership. Why do we have the kinds of leaders that we have? And it also brings us to an issue called evolutionary mismatch, which is that if we are evolved to something and we are placed in a situation where that is not the case, then this is an evolutionary mismatch and it tends to make us unhappy. It's rather like having a dog and locking it in a house all day and not letting it go for a walk. It's an evolutionary mismatch. He's meant to be running around and having a laugh, and so consequently he becomes unhappy. Another example of an evolutionary mismatch would be the relationship we currently have with things like sugar and sweet food. Under evolutionary conditions, it was very rare, very difficult to get hold of, very valued thing. And consequently, when we got hold of it, we'd eat as much of it as we possibly could, because it wouldn't come along again soon. Now, wild honey and the way that hunter-gatherers deal with wild honey is an example of this. So an evolution, that would be an example for us now. It's everywhere. We have access to it all the time. And therefore, that is an evolutionary mismatch. And it's bad for us, and it tends to make us fat, that we have this constant access to this thing that we are evolved to eat, and eat very quickly. So that's the facts, the focus that I want to look at today, is how this has happened, how we have evolved under hunter-gatherer conditions to a certain degree to like certain kinds of leaders, and how this means that certain kinds of leaders are more successful today. Now, if you look at the research from animals, the first basic thing is that animals will follow other animals whom they trust. So we are evolved to follow the person whom we trust. The second thing that you will find in basic tests of leadership among animals is that you simply follow the person who moves first. That's another way that leadership can be created. The person that moves first, you will assume, is more dominant, knows what he's doing, and there is a tendency, therefore, to follow people that move first. Now, that could be, you can see this, for example, if you're ever standing at a set of traffic lights and it's a red and there's no car, there's no car coming, but it's a red man, if you move first and cross the road, you will notice that other people will follow you and do so, because they will trust you and they will assume you know what you're doing. So we're evolved in that way. Now, the way that these bands have evolved is they have leaders that lead them in terms of looking for food, that lead them in terms of conflict, and they have these informal, charismatic leaders. Now, that's our prehistory. What does this mean for today? Well, the first, what is in terms of the kind of people that we want to follow? Well, the first thing is an issue of sexual selection. We want to follow men, and men are more prone to leadership and better at it. Now, what in general? Now, why is this the case? Well, under Darwinian conditions, of course, we have this situation where the male has nothing to lose from the sexual encounter, and so consequently it's in his interest to have sex with as many young, fertile females as he possibly can, and to build up a harem of lots and lots of females so he can pass on lots of his genes. The female has something to lose from the sexual encounter, and consequently she's more picky, she's more selective, because she's more likely to survive, and her offspring are more likely to survive if the man hangs around and invests resources in them. Consequently, females are more likely to sexually select for men who have access to resources, for men who are high up the social hierarchy, because they will be more likely to invest resources in their offspring and in them. And consequently, they are more likely to sexually select for men who are leaders. Men who are leaders in prehistory will have been more likely to get access to females and more likely to pass on their genes. And this will therefore select for leadership qualities in men. Men are more likely to have these qualities that make you a good leader, such as charisma, such as intelligence, such as a certain kind of pro-social personality to a certain extent. Not necessarily empathy, but a certain kind of pro-social personality that you can sort of read people and you can understand their emotions and you can manipulate them. Men are more likely to have those qualities because it was those men that were sexually selected for in prehistory, and those men who passed on their genes. And so this is one way of helping us to understand why we tend to prefer male leaders, and why there tends to be this biased, overwhelming bias to particularly in a business world and whatever, towards male leaders, because men will tend to have these qualities of leadership, this overconfidence, this charisma, this ability to make a cold world feel warm, this ability to inspire people, is something that has literally been selected for in men, because men have been sexually selected, in a sense, for leadership by women. So that's the first thing. The second thing that we can look at is computer models. Computer models have demonstrated that certain kinds of people first of all, there will always end up being a balance in a group between leaders and followers. A group that has too many leader types won't function properly, and there'll be too much conflict. A group that has too many followers, nobody will take charge and nothing will get done. So in these computer models, you get stability, and you see this, of course, naturally in hunter-gatherer bands. You get stability between the kind of people, between the small minority who are the king rats, as it were, and the rest who will follow. So that we can see how this emerges, that the leaders therefore will always be in a minority. Then they've also looked at experiments with testosterone. So we can look at it from a medical perspective. And this has found that males who are high in testosterone will perform cognitively better in tasks when they are in positions of leadership. And men who are low in testosterone will perform cognitively better in tasks when they are in positions of following. And so this, of course, shows you again that there could only be a small percentage of the population who are leaders, and it will be a mismatch. This is, again, a mismatch issue. It will be a mismatch for them if they are not leaders, and they will feel unhappy. So they will be highly, highly competitive competitive and they will want to become leaders, whereas those that are lower down the social hierarchy will, in a sense, want to be followers. They will want to be led. But the testosterone issue then also shows you a crucial thing that's behind leadership, a crucial issue that's there. Again, the relationship with being a man. Testosterone is the male hormone. And so there's a correlation between a male hormone, between manly qualities and wanting to be a leader and performing well when you are a leader. So it's a certain kind of male that under prehistory became leaders, a high testosterone male. Now, why would a high testosterone male become leader? Well, it is because in these conditions, a big part of leadership was fighting. Until relatively recently, we lived in unstable ecologies in which there were lots of warring groups fighting each other. And so what the leader did was he led the band in the fighting. He was the leader. He was the general. He was the generalissimo who was leading people in fighting. Therefore, obviously, to inspire people and to lead them in battle and to win the battle, he had to be good at fighting. And fighting until relatively recently was a physical issue in these battles. And so consequently, he had to be physically fit. He had to be muscular. He had to be tall, and so therefore it militates in favour of leaders being physically fit, being muscular and being tall, being basically a muscular guy. Second issue is how you get to the top of the hierarchy. How do you get to the top of the hierarchy in these kinds of bands? Well, yes, part of it is getting on with people and making alliances and whatever, but part of it ultimately comes down, these unstable ecologies of the Bushmen and whatever, it comes down to physical violence and fighting. Intimidating other people. If you look at the Yanomamo of the Amazonian rainforest, they are extremely violent to their wives, to each other, and it's a way of displaying, don't mess with me, and it's therefore a way of helping them to get to the top of the social hierarchy. So you see, therefore, a hangover, and we'll look at this in a minute, of the kinds of people that we are attracted to in terms of leaders are people who we would see as capable of winning fights, of capable of being physically violent. Okay, now this then moves us on to the next issue, which is, again, who do we see that becomes leaders? Well, there is studies that have indicated according that five-year-olds can pick election winners based on their faces. Based on their faces alone, they can successfully pick who's going to win an election. How are they doing that? Well, what is the face telling them? Well, one of the things that they tend to go for is it's a relatively masculine face. It's a relatively masculine face that will tend to win elections. It's a relatively masculine face that women are optimally attracted to. Interestingly, not too masculine. Not too masculine, but relatively masculine. Too masculine would imply too high in testosterone, which would mean too impulsive, too psychopathic, unable to get on with people, lots of fights, prison, violence, poverty, whatever. So they don't sexually select for men that are overly masculine on the whole. They sexually select men that are quite masculine, because the fact that they've got some feminine traits in relatively primitive human societies such as the Bushmen are important to attaining leadership roles. Yes, you have to be able to fight, you have to be able to win battles with other groups, you have to be able to lead people into battle and whatever, but you can't be too extreme in your testosterone levels, because you have to be able to make alliances, you have to be diplomatic, you have to be able to negotiate with other people, you have to be able to hold your fire at the right moment. If you're a young Turk and you just go for it in the fight at the wrong time, you'll be killed. So you have to be able, you have to have some impulse control and whatever. And they want some, they want men that are to some extent going to care for the children. And so they want feminine ways of thinking to some extent. They want feminine inclinations. So an optimum level of feminization among males will stay in the population. And this means that it's not totally masculine males who will tend to win these kinds of elections. It's males that have the optimum balance. But in general, it is the more masculinized male that will tend to win in the election. And it is the taller male, because height is correlates, of course, with the ability to get on in fights and whatever, will tend to win in elections. An obvious example was the American presidential election 1988 between George Bush and Michael Dukakis. And there was no way that Michael Dukakis was going to win, because Michael Dukakis was just too short. And it may also be relevant, although there were so many other factors involved, in the election of 2008 of Barack Obama versus John McCain, that John McCain was noticeably short. Now, there were other factors as well. Of course, he was also very old, and just there wasn't the Obama mania surrounding him, because, you know, the first non-white presidential candidate and all this kind of stuff. But you know, that's certainly relevant. So this is also highly germane. Now, this is another issue, of course, is is age. Now, again, there are other factors here, but in general, as a rule, among animals, there is a tendency to follow the old. Now, why? Well, because there's a belief that the old will know more. And so within certain boundaries, people tend to quite like leaders that aren't too young. Not too old, because too old equals that they're decrepit and there's things wrong with them and whatever. But they like people that are relatively old. They feel they can trust them. People that are relatively old have wisdom and that sort of thing. And so they tend to go for them. So you have all of these different factors that we're evolved towards in terms of leadership, in terms of the kind of person that we would want to lead us and we would feel happy leading us. And you would expect those to transpose over to today. And if those things don't happen, if we have a different kind of leadership from what we're evolved to have, then we would tend to become unhappy because there would be an evolutionary mismatch. And this is what this fellow Mark van Vught and Richard Bonnet look at in their paper. And they look at it, interestingly, in terms of the management systems in places of work. They note that the way that it often works in terms of management is that a manager will be flown in. So let's say there's a school and the headmaster leaves and they get a new headmaster. Now, what might happen in that situation is that the current deputy headmaster will apply for the job. But often the person that's a deputy headmaster, that he has the skills to be a deputy headmaster, doesn't necessarily mean that he has the skills to be a headmaster. And the board, who are in charge of deciding who becomes headmaster, they'll interview perhaps the current deputy headmaster, but they'll also interview other people from outside. And they may well fly in someone from outside who's got no history at all with the school in question to run the school. Now, a lot of teachers won't like that. They will be unhappy about that. And they often will have preferred it if it was someone from their own group who came to be headmaster. Now, the paper argues that this is exactly as you would expect, because under our evolutionary conditions, this is how leadership works. Leaders are not imposed from the outside. Leaders emerge from among you. They emerge from among the group. The group has a sense of its own dynamics. The group it has to be someone that is part of the group, that is part of the social organisation of which they are a part. Now, the headmaster that's flown in is part of their organisation in the sense that he's from the same country or in the sense that he's a teacher, but he's not part of that particular organisation that he's running. And so this is an example of social mismatch. And there's research that has shown that when leaders emerge from within the organisation, they are often more successful than those that have parachuted in from outside. And this makes sense because we are evolved to a situation in evolution where that's what used to happen. The leader, we would be in a band of people where everybody knew each other essentially, and the leader would emerge from among those people. Now that's of course what happened with Boris. It wasn't that some Labour Party or some Conservative Party or some Liberal Democrat party machine decided this is going to be the candidate and we all have to accept that this is the candidate and you have the option to vote for him or not. It was that he became known to the community independently of politics. He was already known. People already perceived him as part of their community, as one of them. He was on television. He was on Have I Got News For You. He was already famous. And so there's a sense in which he emerged from the community. He wasn't an unknown that was parachuted in from outside. People felt he was part of their community, and therefore I think that gave him a great deal of success with regard to becoming Mayor of London. The same thing is true, I think, of Ken Livingstone. If you go back to the year 2000, when it was the first mayoral election for Mayor of London, Ken Livingstone, it was a choice between someone who wasn't very famous, wasn't very known, who was imposed by the Labour Party, Frank Dobson, and someone who was extremely famous and well-known and was this Londoner who'd long been involved in London politics, in the Great London Assembly and whatever. He'd emerged from among us. And so there was a strong feeling, myself as a Londoner, and I'm a Conservative, I almost voted for him because I was so he was one of us. And these other people that were the candidates, Frank Dobson and whoever the guy that was the Conservative, they weren't from London. They were, who the hell were they? They were one of us. And so this is an important element to leadership. Now, a second element to leadership, as we've already discussed, is the physical element. We like height, we like health. And so this is also an element to who are going to be our leaders. And therefore, this is why Boris Johnson's about average height. He's about 5'9". He's reasonably built and whatever. But that is why short little men, 5'4" or whatever, are unlikely, particularly in societies where people are aware of their height, although there are exceptions, of course, but they are unlikely to emerge as leaders because we are evolved to want our leaders to be physical, because in prehistory, that is what that was the important part of a leader. A leader was a war leader who would literally have to fight in battle to protect us. And so consequently, we wanted somebody who had physical powers. Now, in the paper, they argue this is an evolutionary mismatch. They argue the fact that we like our leaders to be reasonably tall and reasonably well-built, whatever, is an evolutionary mismatch. I'm not sure that's the case, because we know that height correlates with intelligence at about 0.1 among men even now. And so consequently, you can see why you should want to have a relatively tall person as a leader. Secondly, we know that height is a marker of good genes. Height is a marker that you've managed to reach your phenotypic maximum height, despite the fact that you may have had all kinds of pathogens and things you've had to fight off. And so consequently, you would expect a person who was reasonably tall to have better genes, to have lower physical mutational load. And as I've discussed before, physical mutational load correlates with mental mutational load, and the brain is 84% of the genome, and consequently it's a massive target for mutation. And so if you've got mutations of the body making you short, then you'll definitely have mutations of the mind, and therefore you may well be maladaptive and there may well be things wrong with you. And so I'm not sure it is an evolutionary mismatch. You can see why it would be a good idea to want a leader who evidences physical health, whether in terms of a reasonably symmetrical face, whether in terms of not being significantly below average height, or whatever it is, because that would imply good mental health and good mental functioning. And so I'm not sure that's an evolutionary mismatch. Now, the third issue they look at is the issue of women. As discussed, we are evolved to want men to be our leaders. Why? Well, because of the physical element, and also because of sexual selection, and men therefore tending to have, being selected to have better leadership qualities. Now, what the paper argues in a rather politically correct mode is that women are better leaders in some ways. They have better verbal skills, they have better memory. They're less likely to get into conflicts and all this kind of thing, and so therefore it's an evolutionary mismatch that we tend to not want to have women as leaders. I'm not sure that's the case at all. I don't think it's an evolutionary mismatch, because the fact that you are good with verbal skills and you are good at memory, fine, that makes you a good bureaucrat. That makes women good at running organisations in terms of bureaucracy. That's not quite the same thing as leadership. Leadership involves the ability to inspire people. It involves the ability to make people feel that everything's going to be okay. It involves the ability to motivate people. And there's no reason to think that females would be necessarily high in that. In fact, the evidence indicates in terms of studies of charisma that it is men who are more charismatic. And this makes sense because men have been sexually selected to be charismatic. So I don't think that's an evolutionary mismatch at all with regard to the bias towards men. The bias towards male leadership makes sense. Females are probably going to, or are likely, I would argue, to be better bureaucrats. But that's a different thing from leadership. That's bureaucracy. That's something lower down the scale. Perhaps it's a kind of semi-leadership, but the overall leader is more likely to be male because males are more charismatic and therefore they can inspire people. And that is a very big part of leadership. It's not just bureaucracy. This is then another issue that the paper raises, which is in terms of another potential mismatch, which is, of course, we want and we prefer to know everything about our leaders. This is another issue with Boris. There's a degree to which we know a lot about him. We just had a child. He seems to have had other children. We're not even sure how many children he's had. He lives his life in public. And that was the case in prehistory. That's what we're evolved to. We're evolved to want to judge our leaders by their private lives, to judge them as people. You can argue that this is a mismatch now, that we don't need to do these things. These things aren't as important in the modern world, and that may be the case. But what wouldn't be at all surprising is if managers, middle managers even, who were very open about their lives and who therefore people felt that they knew, would get on better than those who were very private about their lives. I think this is relevant in terms of recent political leadership in Britain. If you look at someone like Theresa May, who's very private and very guarded and whatever and doesn't like to talk about her feelings, and you can try it with someone like Boris, who is prepared to do that. Boris is a lot more interesting and a lot more inspiring as a leader because he is like that. Because you feel you know a person, you feel that they're one of the community if they tell you all about themselves and about their feelings and whatever. Even John Major was very into doing that, and if you read his memoir, he's extremely open. So this is another issue which has been suggested to be a mismatch, but I'm not sure it is a mismatch. It's not a mismatch. It's we are evolved to this situation. and we will feel more inspired, and inspiration is a big part of leadership. Now, finally, in summing up, they make a number of suggestions with regard to how, in management organisations and whatever, you can apply the principles of evolutionary psychology to be more successful as an organisation. One of them is shared leadership. So therefore, there should be more sharing of leadership, because under evolutionary conditions, that's how it tended to be. You'd have one person who... There was no clear leader, often, of these most primitive hunter-gatherer bands. There'd be the shaman who was in charge of that sort of thing, in charge of the religious aspect, the spiritual aspect. There'd be the person that was the best at fighting, that would come into play when there was intergroup conflict. There'd be the person that was the best at other things, I don't know, finding food or hunting or something like that. So there should be shared leadership. The second thing they argue is that we're used to small functional units in which we can hold the leader accountable and remove him if we don't like him. And consequently, it's argued that social organisations should be divided into small functional units. And there should therefore be lots of delegation, lots of decentralisation. And so that consequently, people have a feeling when working for a company that they are working in a group that is about the size of the group that we are used to under these conditions of Darwinian selection, under hunter-gatherer bands. I'm not sure that's quite right, as I say, because I think that we've evolved, certainly Europeans and more complex societies, have evolved to much larger groups. But nevertheless, that's what they suggest would work. And there is some evidence that it does work, the fact that companies work better if they do this and are more productive if they do this. A third thing is the issue of leadership selection. And so the leadership of any organisation, of any group, should always emerge from among them, and should not be imposed from outside. And I think this is quite important in terms of politics as well, that if you look at what used to happen, which would be that somebody would just emerge as the leader of the Conservative Party after lots of backroom talking and whatever, and there was a feeling among the members of the party, among the party members, that this wasn't very fair, that we don't have a say, and this person has just emerged and we have to accept them, and we don't like this. And I think that obviously the members of the Conservative Party are much happier now that they have a chance to elect their leader. And of course but the problem then comes if that leader hasn't emerged from among the members of Parliament. So he's a leader of the party members in the country, but he hasn't actually emerged from among the members of Parliament. So you have this problematic disconnect there, that he's supported by one group and not the other. Now, Boris, of course, it works, because he's supported overwhelmingly by the party membership, and he has substantial support among the parliamentary party, probably the majority if they had to vote, if it had been with him and Hunt, probably. But you have the other extreme, which is you have someone like Ian Duncan Smith, who had the support of the party members, but very little support among the parliamentary party, or Jeremy Corbyn, support of the party members, very little support among the parliamentary party. Then they haven't emerged from among them, and it's a problem. The next one that has been shown to be relevant is the issue of leadership selection. So the leaders have to be seen to have emerged properly. It can't be seen through bribery or whatever. They have to have emerged through their own merits, through, if you like, fighting to the top, which is what would have occurred under these earlier conditions. Then they look at various other issues, which, such as how you become a leader. This is also quite important in the modern world, how you become a leader. They look at you becoming through bribery, through giving everyone public goods, that's how you maintain your leadership, through winning a war, through controlling information, or simply through killing your rivals. Now, this, of course, is a problem, because it means that one of the things that tends to allow you to become a leader is overconfidence. Now, under these pre-modern conditions, in these tribal organisations, if the overconfident person, you know, who can talk his way into the leadership, who isn't really competent to be a leader, but he's overconfident, and he manages to become a leader, and he inspires people with his confidence, and he makes people believe that he's going to be brilliant. Well, if he's very, very bad, then in a tribal organisation, he can be easily removed. Indeed, he'll be killed. He'll just be removed by the band if he's no good at it. It's much more difficult to remove people that get into positions of power through overconfidence and aren't really any good in more complex societies. And so perhaps that is an evolutionary mismatch that we have to be very careful of, not just in the country at large, but in social organisations. The person who simply comes across as confident, who doesn't have any of the other dimensions of leadership necessarily, but simply comes across as confident, that comes there with lots of big plans and things he's going to do, that person is a person we should be suspicious of, because it's more difficult to get rid of him with all of the bureaucracy that we have than it would have been. We are evolved to be attracted to the person who's extremely confident, because normally with, but because in prehistory, if he is extremely confident and useless, we can remove him. And normally, if he's extremely confident, it's probably because he's charismatic and he'll be a good leader. Now, we have this problem now where we are still attracted to these kinds of people, but there's no costs to them messing up because it's harder to get rid of them. And so that is a problem then, and it was extremely confident leadership in the modern world. But anyway, that's the research. That's the research on the evolutionary psychology of modern day leadership. And I hope it is a bit of interest. And I would like to thank Oliver Rayner Hills Esquire for funding this video. And if you would like to fund me, then of course you can do so through Subscribestar, through you can see the list of the video, PayPal, offline super chat, which is how this was done. Do remember that we are at the moment live streaming twice a week, once on Mondays at 7 p.m. British time, and then on Thursdays 7 p.m. British time. So do tune in, and I will see you soon, and goodbye.